Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on President Donald Trump's potential U.S. Supreme Court pick. There's a call for Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill to resign after allegations of sexual misconduct. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Senator Joe Donnelly about a few concerns he's taking up on the Hill on behalf of all Hoosiers. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Lakeshore Public Radio's Chris Nolte had an opportunity to speak with U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly Friday morning. Here's the conversation.
We have Senator Joe Donnelly with us this morning to bring us up to date on what's been happening on Capitol Hill and in the districts here in Indiana. Senator, thank you for being with us here on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
Talk here about the work that you've done to support the state's role in the nation's defense and our security interests all across the country, and jobs as well, too, with your support to put in some very Indiana-specific provisions in the National Defense Bill. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, we were able to include in the defense bill my amendment that helps with defeating the opioid scourge, the problems we've had with that. I have included a telemedicine program, so it would be in many of our rural counties where people can simply use the U.S. Department of Agriculture services to be able to talk to Northwestern Hospital in Chicago, a specialist, mm-hmm. or to Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, a specialist, something like that. We were able to get almost a 3% pay raise for our men and women who serve in the military, and for our facilities in Indiana, we were able to get strong assistance for all of them, whether it's Crane in southern Indiana or Grissom over in Miami County, the 122nd Air Base in Fort Wayne. So across the board, we were able to get significant assistance because our missions have been so critical to the nation's security.
I know that another measure that you had worked on and supported was and spoke out on, actually, was what the Trump administration wanted to do and said so in a court brief about health insurance, in particular protections for pre-existing conditions for people, and it should be ruled unconstitutional. What's your concern about what's going to happen not only to Hoosiers, but also the impact it's going to have in the marketplace, for that matter?
Well, the administration is clearly trying to destroy the health insurance that we've had for years. And pre-existing conditions is just a fancy name for having a child with asthma or someone who's dealing with arthritis or diabetes. And the administration, the Department of Justice, has joined a lawsuit to try to end coverage for pre-existing conditions, which is almost unbelievable. But what they are doing is making it so that if you have a child with asthma, if you have a family member with multiple sclerosis, they'll likely not be able to get coverage, or coverage will be so expensive that it will be unaffordable in the months ahead. And so I'm working nonstop to stop this.
One of the other issues, which has an update even today, talks about the tariffs, what some are characterizing now as a trade war, in particular between the U.S. and China. We know the tariffs between those two countries began to kick in today. What are your thoughts here about what we're facing now in regards to the possibility that this so-called trade war may continue?
Well, I've always been supportive of making sure that our steel mills in Northwest Indiana could compete fairly. And so we've worked on that. But what we've seen is these tariffs have done incredible damage to our agricultural community. It never needed to occur. This has expanded into something that's going to damage our economy. And so we were able to help the Northwest Indiana steel mills, but we didn't have to cause incredible heartache and damage to our farmers in the process. And we could certainly have a better trade policy than we have right now.
Is there anything that you feel that you can do and the rest of your colleagues in the Senate and the House of Representatives, for that matter, to try to get the president to back off on all this?
Yeah, we can look at legislation to try to roll back some of the damage that's occurred with China and with our farmers, so that our farmers are in a position where they're not worried about losing their family farm that's been in the family for generation after generation.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things, too, that has come up and we're keeping an eye on here, we're supposed to know sometime Monday evening from President Trump, is his choice to fill the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy caused by the retirement of Justice Kennedy. We know that that there's even a Northern Indiana connection to all this, too. And tell us your thoughts here about the vacancy and who you would like to see and might support, because, of course, it'll come up for confirmation in the Senate for the seat on the Supreme Court.
Well, I've said from the start that I would support a moderate who, I am looking for a moderate who is common sense, who is in the mold of an Anthony Kennedy, who can focus on trying to just do what's right and not play extreme partisan politics. And so I'll be looking at whatever nominee comes before us. I'll carefully review the record. I'll carefully review everything that comes before me. And so I don't have any particular nominee that that I've been supporting, but I will review whoever comes before us.
Senator Joe Donnelly, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson and city officials will present the city's financial plan on Tuesday, July 10th at 7 p.m. The public is invited to the presentation that will discuss the city's financial status as well as the city's five-year financial plan. Time will be available for questions and answers. The presentation will be held at Gary Art House, a social kitchen, 411 East 5th Avenue. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's Inspector General will investigate sexual misconduct allegations against Attorney General Curtis Hill. Lori Torres announced Friday her office will look into the accusations after the governor and legislative leaders requested the inquiry. Hill is accused of groping four women at a party in March celebrating the end of the legislative session. The Inspector General's role is to investigate and address fraud, waste, abuse, and wrongdoing in any executive branch agency. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. On President Donald Trump's short list of potential Supreme Court nominees, the candidate sparking the fiercest debate is a self-possessed Chicago U.S. Court of Appeals judge who's been on the bench less than a year. That lack of judicial experience means former University of Notre Dame law professor Amy Coney Barrett has a slim record of rulings for a potential Supreme Court nominee. That void of information about her judicial identity is being filled with the anxieties and hopes of commentators across the political spectrum. Barrett's opponents have interpreted her scholarly articles and Catholic faith as suggesting she is a religious extremist who could be willing to overturn precedent and end legal abortion. For her part, Barrett's public statements have not clearly indicated that she thinks Roe can or should be overturned. Supporters and former colleagues, however, describe an exacting legal thinker committed to separating her faith from her interpretation of the Constitution and law. On Thursday, national news organizations reported that Trump was focused on Barrett and fellow federal appeals judges Brett Kavanaugh and Raymond Ketledge to fill retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy's spot. Trump told reporters he was down to four candidates. A formal announcement is planned for Monday, but word of the president's pick could emerge sooner. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's Secretary of State is seeking Lake County voters' input on how to advance a plan to consolidate small voting precincts in the Northwest Indiana County. Connie Lawson said Tuesday her office wants to hear from voters, quote, about how to make this consolidation work best for you. A 2017 law required Lake County to develop a plan for consolidating voting precincts with fewer than 600 active voters. Lawmakers this year amended the law to give the Indiana Election Committee until July 1st to identify those precincts. The Post Tribune reports the legislation says that if the commission cannot adopt a plan, that duty will fall to the Secretary of State. A law that challenged the consolidation law was put on hold because it couldn't contest a plan that didn't exist yet. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. An East Chicago man has been sentenced to 4 years in prison for the fatal accidental shooting of his 4-year-old nephew. 23-year-old Lamario Delgado Gonzalez told a judge Monday that he was sorry for fatally shooting Garyon Glover Jr. in May 2017 at an East Chicago apartment. The Times reports the East Chicago man sobbed while telling the court he loved his nephew unconditionally. Delgado Gonzalez pleaded guilty in May to reckless homicide and admitted that he unintentionally shot his nephew. The boy's mother told police she was awakened by a noise and found her son bleeding on the floor not far from a couch where Delgado Gonzalez had been sleeping. Delgado Gonzalez was arrested in Illinois in December. He told police he was in a, quote, marijuana coma at the time of the shooting. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A southern Indiana cave is home to a new species of spider. An assistant professor of biology at the University of Indianapolis discovered the species, which is being called Islandiana luisi. It's the first new spider in its genus to be found over 30 years. Mark Millen named the tiny, pale-colored, sheep-weaving spider after his colleague, Julian Lewis, who clued him in to the arachnid's existence. Millen's specialty is small spiders, and while he has discovered a number of new species in his work, he says this one is special.
Especially these sheep-web weavers that we're talking about, it's very unusual. It's very normal for some of these spiders not to get looked at or recorded or collected or studied in decades.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The United States is using less water than it has in more than 45 years, but still some worry we won't have enough in the future. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Till reports, that's cause for concern, especially in Indiana, a state that relies on water to run its economy.
The new study by the U.S. Geological Survey shows there are many reasons why the U.S. isn't using as much water. The biggest ones are that Texas and California imposed restrictions on water use due to drought, and that the country is using less coal. Still, in 2015, Indiana withdrew the most water for industrial uses of any state in the country. USGS hydrologist Cheryl Dieter is the lead author of the report. She says many of Indiana's major industries need a lot of water.
Processes related to auto manufacturing, also some medical and orthopedic devices, pharmaceuticals.
The Indiana Chamber of Commerce says state leaders need to do more to ensure that residents aren't competing with industry for water in the future. Last year, the state passed a bill to help communities build more water infrastructure, but lawmakers haven't funded the effort. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Lake County Sheriff's deputy cleared 4 months ago of a rape charge has been suspended for posting an unauthorized social media video. The Times reports that Nicholas Madrano was suspended for 5 days. The brief Instagram video shows the 35-year-old Lake County deputy transporting an inmate, and both were smiling and bobbing their heads to music. County Police Chief William Patterson says the video constituted unauthorized dissemination of department information. The Sheriff's Department also says it is looking into a stalking complaint made by a woman who says she previously had a relationship with Madrano. Officials would not comment further. Madrano has an unlisted telephone number and could not be reached for comment Wednesday. Prosecutors dropped 2017 rape charges against Madrano earlier this year because of insufficient evidence. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana University research identified a tiny molecule that may signal the presence of some types of dementia. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports, researchers say this could be a first step to developing an early test for Alzheimer's.
The research aimed to detect a type of microRNA before signs of neurodegenerative disease. Indiana University professor Hoi Chen Liu led the recent study. She says microRNA is ideal because of its stability.
There's something actually protecting them from getting degraded. And the great thing is they are actually in plasma.
Blood. It can also be detected in urine. So scientists are interested in using it as a possible biomarker. Liu's research tested mice to confirm microRNA changes related to neuroinflammation associated with dementia. The next step will be to see if molecules can be detected in a biomarker. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Purdue University professor has developed technology he hopes will make fireworks safer. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the new app and remote firing device allow for pyrotechnics to be triggered at a distance.
ZapSpark's setup is simple. Connect fireworks to igniter cables and then snap the igniter clip into the firing device. An app tells the device to send an electric current through the wires, causing them to heat up and then... Purdue engineering professor Mituna Totitoti says activating the fireworks from a phone is safer than lighting them by hand, an act that results in more than 10,000 injuries every year.
The realization was we are all carrying around these phones, which have powerful radios and computing all right there. So why not use that to let consumers have some distance between them and the fireworks?
If a crowdfunding campaign shows there's interest in the device, it could be available for less than $100. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Health officials are concerned about the swine flu or H3N2 variant virus's ability to mutate. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan brings us more on the virus's reappearance in the state, the first reported case in 5 years.
The Indiana State Department of Health, ISDH, sent an advisory last week to warn Hoosiers headed to county fairs to avoid contact with pigs after a confirmed case of H3N2V. ISDH outbreak supervisor Sean Richards says swine flu viruses don't normally infect people.
What we're concerned about is when it changes enough to become transmitted from person to person with that variant flu, because people wouldn't have as much immunity to it.
There have only been about 400 cases of this variation since 2011, and more than a third have been in Indiana. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. New regulations for cannabidiol, or CBD, are meant to help consumers and law enforcement. CBD has been legal in Indiana since March, but now it's required to come with a QR code. It's a type of barcode that can be scanned by a smartphone, which will take you to a page with information about the product. There, consumers will find information that includes an independent lab analysis, ingredients, and the product's expiration date. The law kicked in on July 1st, and retailers worked ahead of time to make sure they were in compliance. Galen Buckner is the Midwest Apothecary Specialist for Lucy's Market. She says the process takes time.
Thankfully, we've been able to work with our specific vendors, and they've been sending us the codes and stuff like that to put our own products. As we do have a couple of products that we're still working the codes out with, and that's why we have some couple of empty spaces.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Volunteers at a Randolph County food pantry spent their time with U.S. Senator Todd Young asking him not to vote to reduce federal food assistance programs through the next version of the federal farm bill. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stephanie Weichman reports, Young visited several service agencies in Winchester Thursday.
Ron Ferguson, along with his wife Pam, helped run the Shalom Center in Winchester, an all-volunteer food pantry that helped feed more than 14,000 people last year. Ferguson says if food assistance programs are reduced or cut, the pantry would see up to 100 more families a month, something not financially feasible for the organization. Ferguson appealed directly to Republican Senator Todd Young.
Vegetables, fruit, canned dried chicken. Fruit, all of that is TFAP. That came to us at no cost whatsoever, and it's the staple stuff. It's a huge part of what we give to people.
A House version of the Farm Bill reduces such programs. A Senate version does not. Young says he'll take the Ferguson's concerns to the Congressional Conference Committee deciding the bill's final version.
And I would anticipate voting for the Farm Bill in the end, regardless.
While on his tour, Young suggested food pantry clients receive counseling on how to free up some money to better afford food. That's a service that the food pantry supplier, Second Harvest Food Bank of Muncie, already offers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weekman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. An Indiana social worker recently received the National Social Worker of the Year Award from the National Association of Social Workers. Purdue University's Kimber Nicoletti Martinez was recognized for developing a statewide program to prevent sexual violence in the underserved and marginalized, with an emphasis on farm workers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan spoke with Nicoletti Martinez, who is the director of the statewide program Multicultural Efforts to End Sexual Assault, or MESA.
Tell us where your work started, when you realized, you know, there's a great need for this in Indiana and I have to do this.
Well, my work actually started was with my academic advisor at Purdue University. I'm a Purdue alum. I was a single mother and I had three daughters, and I'm a survivor of child sexual abuse. Was always wanting to make a difference in the world, and I worked as a farm worker as a child and have a passion for farm worker communities. And so to me, it was a natural fit when I came to Purdue to work at CARE Communities Against Rape Initiative that we start doing outreach with farm worker communities.
And you actually created the first farm worker child sexual abuse prevention program. What did that look like and how did you come up with that idea?
Well, that was built upon work that I started in CARE, where we were doing sexual violence prevention work. I actually had heard some stories along the way where people had disclosed things to me. They said, you know, Kimber, we're having some problems with our daughter, and she cries every night at dinner. And for the family, they thought it was a behavioral issue. And to me, it looked like possible symptoms of a child that was being sexually abused.
Well, obviously, you know, you're passionate about working with those that are underrepresented. Is there a great need for that here in Indiana?
There is a great need for that in Indiana. And the thing is that for a lot of people in these communities, they're not able to get their needs met by going through mainstream efforts, or services aren't available that are culturally appropriate for those communities. For a lot of marginalized communities, sometimes like with the farm worker community, when I first started doing that work, people were surprised to find out that there were migrant farm workers in Indiana.
Children here in Indiana, you know, in families in these populations, what are the risks that some of these children are facing?
In a recent study, farm worker women, 90% of farm worker women say that they face sexual harassment in the field. And sexual harassment ranges from any kind of behavior from, you know, lewd name calling to actual rape. And so, and because of labor laws regarding, you know, seasonal and farm work, you often have underage people under employment law. They might say, you know, that they're a victim of sexual harassment, when in reality, it's a child who's been sexually assaulted. You know, risk factors for child sexual abuse has to do with income, female-headed households, limited English capacity, a lot of the same risk factors for sexual violence.
Your work as a social worker, I want to talk about that broadly. I think there's a greater understanding of the need for social workers.
Really, social work really looks at empowering and advocating for people, whether, you know, regardless of the setting. So it can be in a school-based setting, it can be in a medical setting, and it's really about providing unconditional positive regard for humans, right, for people, and at the same time helping create access and social justice for those people.
Your program here, we're sitting at Purdue University, first campus-based violence prevention program for people LGBTQ, bilingual, bicultural. What success has that program has had, and what's that looked like here?
So really looking at a primary prevention approach and looking at how is gender-based violence, where does it start? And so it starts in institutions, right? So if we can create institutions that embrace people, as well as addressing the more personal level of violence prevention, which comes at the interpersonal level.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. When Dean Foods decided to end procurement contracts with 27 of its 28 Hoosier farmers, dairy experts worried about the ramifications. Some farmers were lucky enough to find new markets for their milk, others were not. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brock Turner reports, farmers were initially confident they could find new markets for their milk, but reps that used to call regularly are not interested anymore. And that's leading some to take desperate measures in hopes of keeping their farms.
John Claycamp says dairy farming is in his blood. He's been the owner of Lot Hill Dairy Farm in Jackson County for nearly 30 years. With his wife by his side, he's raised four kids and hundreds of cattle.
Now those cows, you know, they get breakfast first, and they get dinner first, and that's just the way it is.
Claycamp grew up on the farm. He and his father still work 7 days a week to ensure the cows are happy and healthy. He says there is nothing else he'd rather be doing.
Right or wrong, they always come first. Cows are out, cows having calves, cows need milk, and they need fed. That's just the way it is, and you do tend to put that before everything else.
This pasture in rural Jackson County was once home to more than 100 dairy cows. Now, Claycamp milks less than 40. The rising costs of feed and supplies paired with a decreased demand for milk has caused farmers like John across Indiana and the nation to cut the number of cows they milk. In 1975, the average American drank 8.5 ounces of liquid milk every day. Today, Americans drink about 5 ounces. Indiana Dairy Producers Executive Director Doug Lehman says farmers across Indiana will continue to be forced to make difficult decisions about their futures.
You know, we got to be real about it.
Lehman was a dairy farmer for nearly 40 years. He raised his family on the farm. But in 2011, Lehman quit milking cows because the margins were too slim to support his family. He says it was the hardest decision of his life.
Life does go on after milking cows. I can attest to that myself, so... There is life after milking cows. I want people to understand that, too. We're not wanting anybody to have to get out, but some may have to make those tough decisions.
2 out of every 3 Indiana dairy farms have closed up shop since 1997. That year, there were nearly 3,000 dairy farms in Indiana. Today, there are less than 1,000, and the situation continues to get worse.
We're all helpless at this time. There's not really anything I can personally do to come out and affect them getting a market. We can help with the communications, and that's what I'm trying to do. But, you know, we cannot force somebody to take them on as a customer.
It is unclear exactly why Dean Foods pulled contracts from nearly all Hoosier farmers. The company declined to comment for this story, but in a statement wrote increased competition and the introduction of new plants at a time when there is an industry-wide surplus of fluid milk, processing capacity forced us into this position. During what Dean Foods called a period of overproduction, the state recently celebrated the opening of another plant. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb says the plant is a win for everyone involved.
The area farmers and all the folks that we're going to be able to supply and stock, including 5 states, but at the end of the day, this is a huge win for consumers.
This new Walmart facility in Fort Wayne is one of the largest in the country. Some former Dean Foods producers got contracts from Walmart, but not all of them. It's estimated that 6 producers in Indiana haven't found a new market. Claycamp is among them. He admits the easiest thing to do would be to sell his dairy farm, but he doesn't want to leave the industry he's dedicated his life to without putting up a fight. That's why every Saturday, he attends a local farmer's market in Seymour.
I can help you. I am sold out. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
He loads up his trailer and brings coolers filled with gelato, milk, and cheese.
The only thing I have left is Pepper Jack.
I'm not Walmart. I don't need to make millions of dollars a year. I just want to make the farm payment, you know, and that's it.
Isn't that wonderful? Here's a spoon.
In the meantime, Claycamp will savor every moment he gets with his cows out on the pasture, and he'll keep fine-tuning his recipes. Folks debate whether his chocolate milk has too much chocolate or not enough. For now, he's going to stick with his current recipe. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
Thank you. Hey, you come back and tell me how that was, okay? All right, bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Lauren Reducen and Ellen Capitan of South Shore Roller Girls.
This is Richly speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The South Shore Roller Girls have been around for a while. In fact, they're celebrating a birthday coming up. We'll find out more about that in just a few minutes here. But Northwest Indiana has a Roller Derby League, and you may not be aware of that. So that's why we have two members of the South Shore Roller Girls with us here in the studio to talk about the team and about how long they've been around and what they've been doing. And the fact they have a call out later this week, in fact, July 8th, the South Shore Roller Girls will be putting out a derby call out. We have in the studio with us two members of the team. We have Lauren Reducen and we have Ellen Kaptan with us. Ladies, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us.
Excited to be here.
Well, first, Lauren, I'll let you start since you're the spokesperson for the group here, and we'll bring Ellen into the conversation too. Tell us, how did the South Shore Roller Girls get started?
So we were part of another league back in 2012 to 2013, and they had disbanded. We had still had a majority of the girls that still wanted to skate, so we just kind of rallied together and put together what we have now, which is the now South Shore Roller Girls.
Now, how many girls are in the team right now?
Currently, I believe we have about 35 active members.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's enough to field two teams. Uh-huh. So
I guess the question comes down to, are there that many girls in Northwest Indiana that, A, can roller skate well enough to compete with other teams in the league, and altogether that are basically very much involved in this and the camaraderie that you have that in creating such a league like this?
Yes. Everything, yes. we have a lot of girls on our league that have never even put on skates before they joined us, and mm-hmm. Yeah,
I take it Ellen must be one of them. Or have you been skating before, Ellen?
I've been skating now for 5 years, but I started as it was like my first time putting skates on, and I mm-hmm. put on also pads and a helmet, and I was ready to go. And people talk about not skating before, and I say it sounds a little nerve-wracking to put on skates to probably fall down, but a lot of us started that way, and mm-hmm. We'll talk about that with our call out as well, as we give you the tools you need to be successful, and it's just a lot of heart.
Yeah.
How popular is roller derby here in Northwest Indiana, or for this part of the country, for that matter?
Oh, it's very popular. There are teams from all over the world, actually. If you go to any state, there's almost a guarantee that there's going to be a roller derby team locally. Mm-hmm. So right now, just in the Northwest Indiana region, we kind of covered that area. We've just expanded a little bit. You know, we were in Michigan City for an event this last weekend, and a lot of people even out that way didn't know that there was roller derby out here. So it's slowly but surely getting bigger and bigger.
With the team being now 5 years old, what were the origins of it? If you got started, got together 5 years ago and skated, or some of you didn't skate, what got you interested in creating a team of your own here?
Well, like I said, we were part of another league prior to this, and then we just didn't want to see it go. We just wanted to continue on and see what we could make of what we have now, and it was probably the best decision half of us have ever made.
What do you have in mind that when you created a roller derby team like this that got you together to begin with and kept you together all these years? Aside from being out there and fighting it out on the skates every single week or weekend.
One of the things that keeps me going are the friendships I've made. Mm-hmm. I've made some of the best friends you could ever imagine. The events that we host, the events that we go to, the fact that we give back to the community, it's just everything. It's not just the sport part of it. It's just everything that roller derby entails.
How many other teams are out there besides the South Shore Roller Girls?
Oh, gosh.
In the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, there's, I think, currently right around 400 teams, and that's worldwide.
Yeah.
But there's also teams that are not within that association, so
there's
I'm not sure.
There's men roller derby
men's
league.
Men's roller junior teams.
There's junior teams, which there's even a junior league out here as well. There's different forms of roller, like different, I guess, not types of roller derby, different rule sets of roller derby. I believe
right.
There's like three other rule sets as well. So, I mean, we're looking at probably closer to maybe like 800 different leagues around the world.
Now, how many teams do you get to compete with on a regular basis here in Northwest Indiana?
I think we have competed against probably closer to 25 other leagues.
Wow.
And the furthest I think that they've came from, I don't think have been further than 4 hours away. Uh-huh. So, I mean, you're talking like Southern Indiana, Southern Illinois. Our next team is actually Southern Illinois that's coming up to play with us. We've done Wisconsin, a ton of teams in Illinois, just everywhere.
Now, how about here in Indiana? Are there any other teams here, and maybe not necessarily in Northwest Indiana, but say within a four-hour drive of here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Chicago has two teams. There's in Linwood, Illinois, there's a team. Aurora, South Bend, Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, I mean, just Lafayette, everywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you would all have to have someplace to be able to practice.
Yes.
Where do you practice when you're all together as the South Shore Roller Girls?
Currently, we are practicing at the Gary Armory, mm-hmm. which is just right in Gary. It fields our little location very nicely.
We've practiced at the Gene Shepherd Center in Hammond. We've practiced
Hammond Civic Center.
Yep.
NEO. It's the Adult Education Center in Portage. It used to be the old Camelot building, and it was turned into an adult education school. And they still have their sportsplex up, so they allowed us to skate there.
I know that there are also regular locations that are set up for skating. Skate mm-hmm. World's one of them in Portage.
Yes.
And I guess that's where you basically kind of work out of a lot, I understand. But what does it take to be able to set up a track, I guess it is, not only to practice, because you have to practice in what we consider real-world conditions. That is, you're going to have to practice someplace that are the type of conditions that you would actually have to compete in.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to be able to set up a track that's banked and also that you get the experience and not only the experience but the actual workout that you need to do to be able to perform and compete?
Well, one thing that we have to clear, we are actually not on a bank track anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in the 70s when roller derby kind of, I guess, fell out. Roller derby was founded in the 30s, I believe.
Well, I understand. Yeah, that's the question to bring in. So you go back when you talk about going back into the 20th century
mm-hmm.
when the idea came about.
Yes. So we're on a flat track now,
which really makes our life a lot easier. Yes, we don't have to find really a place does. For the track to be all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's a little. Never been on a bank track. I'm a little too scared to use it, but I'm thankful that we don't have to set it up.
Yes.
I think the first thing that we look for our track is, well, flat ground. We can play play on anywhere from polished concrete to wooden floors, like you'll find at most skate rinks. Sport court's another mm-hmm. good one. And we have very specific measurements for our track that we have to find. So before every practice, we are out measuring the track, laying it down, helping each other out. It takes,
I would say, about 10 minutes during just a practice to set up our track.
Right.
But then for game day, I think we need at least a minimum of an hour to 2 hours to set up a track because we have to measure it out, you know, for the requirements, and we have to tape it down and put rope down and tape it down some more and, you know, measure every 10 feet. There's a lot more work to go into like an actual game day track than there is for like a practice track.
We're talking with Lauren Reducen and Ellen Capitan. They're members of the South Shore Roller Girls, which is a Portage-based team of young women that are involved in roller skating. And, of course, the history of roller skating is going back many, many years. But in particular, the idea of a roller derby goes back at least, I would think, you said the 1930s. Probably we know it mainly from the idea that the roller teams ended up on television as some of the very first television shows when people had black and white TVs and they had a chance to actually buy them or watch at somebody's house. Roller derby was one of the first shows that were on. I know that I'm sure that's probably where the history goes back into particular. Did you know of any teams that made it on television here in the Chicago area?
I don't think I have really looked back that far. Fortunately, I do have a fun fact though. At the Hammond Civic Center is where roller derby used to play back in the day in this area.
Right.
And the last game was, I believe, in 1973, if I'm not mistaken. And our team was the first one to bring it back to the Hammond Civic Center back at the end of 2015.
Maybe I should ask the question. I wouldn't hate to be embarrass anybody, but did any of your mothers roller skate and get involved in teams? Or did you have friends or family members or relatives that maybe were involved in roller derby teams?
Not that they've told us.
Right, yeah.
But they would admit to, right? I suppose they would be too embarrassed. But somebody had to know about this ahead of time, and you had to know about this or learn this from other people to be able to keep – even in the last 5 years since the Roller Girls have been in existence, to keep the idea of roller derby alive.
Yes.
Well, I would say an interesting thing happening right now with roller derby is that it's becoming even more mainstream than it had been. Mm-hmm. With the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, there's a lot of rules and protocol to follow and a lot of steps to get through to be recognized as that. So when we think back to the roller derby that was on TV, if you did a side-by-side comparison, it would almost feel like unrecognizable. I see pictures where people aren't wearing helmets, and I get a little...
It was almost like combat.
Yeah, I worry about them.
Really dangerous.
Throwing elbows, clotheslining people.
That's what people ask me if I'm clotheslining, and I said I could, but then I get a penalty and I have to sit out.
So it's basically like full body checks now, legally.
One of the things that we wanted to mention about not only the team itself, but the fact that they have an open call out coming up on July 8th. And Lauren, tell us about who all you're interested in bringing in at the call out in Portage this weekend.
We are interested in everyone coming out as long as you're over the age of 18. Mm-hmm. You do not have to have any prior experience with skating. You don't have to have any prior knowledge of roller derby. We will literally teach you everything. Now, when it comes to the actual sport part of it, we are asking women only. But if you want to become a referee, a non-skating official, men and women are more than welcome to come out.
By the way, the call-out is coming out here on July 8th. It's going to be at Skate World, which is at 3600 Scottsdale Street in Portage. And you can learn about what roller derby is all about. And you mentioned that there are people, I guess, involved in this, referees and all, people mm-hmm. that don't have to skate. But I suppose that if you want to be a referee, that you have to have some knowledge of roller skating, number one.
Yes.
And number two, you have to know a little bit about what roller derby is all about.
Right. Well, that's another thing is that we teach you everything.
Right.
So when it comes to reffing, you do have to go through pretty much the same program to learn everything. You have to do the same skills that we have to know. I think a little bit more with like stopping, I guess, in case if a girl gets thrown into you, you have to know how to stop that. But we literally will teach you everything from skating to, you know, what penalties are what, you know, different hand signals when it comes to the actual gameplay of it, you know, just literally everything we will teach you.
Now, we talked about the open call out, which is coming up on July 8th in Portage. We mentioned the fact that the South Shore Roller Girls are a team, members of a team that are now in the fifth year. Your fifth birthday is coming up here.
That's super exciting.
It was obviously you're going to have something important to show to everybody that shows up for the fifth birthday. It's more than just a celebration of itself. There's actually going to be competition that day, and I guess a doubleheader, I understand.
Yes, the doubleheader. We will be having the Lake Effects Junior Roller Derby team, which is another local team. Mm-hmm. It's for children ages, I believe, 9 to 17 that want to get involved in roller derby. They're going to be having a mixer. So it's basically just kind of junior leagues from all over the state as well. They will be opening up for us. This will be the first time that they've actually been like having a game in Northwest Indiana, so that's super exciting. And then we will be showcasing our skills and everything at about 7:30. Our game will be starting, and we will be competing against the Southern Illinois Roller Girls.
Now, we should mention that the fifth birthday bout and the doubleheader are going to happen on Saturday, July 14th, and it's going to happen not in Portage, but at the old ground, so to speak,
the Hammond Civic Center.
Hammond. So.
And there's not a bad seat in that place. It's all amazing seating.
Well, that's why I would think that you would want to have a chance if you're going to go out there and give it your all, not only for your team members, but for everybody that shows up. You want to have everybody have a chance to be able to see everything. It's even better than going to a baseball game,
yes,
I would imagine.
Absolutely.
For folks that are not familiar necessarily with the Hammond Civic Center, tell us first where it is and how people can get in, and tell us a little bit about the place itself, because it has that history of roller derby in it.
Sure. So the Hammond Civic Center is headed north on Calumet past 94. It's always a little further than I think it's going to be.
Yeah.
I adore the Hammond Civic Center. the wood flooring there is very reminiscent of old school Derby. And Lauren talked about the seating. They have like a stadium style seating, so you can sit up in the second tier bleachers and get a bird's eye view of the whole competition. I really enjoy being there because I feel like the Civic Center has all these secrets. There's the downstairs locker rooms. There's different staircases. I always enjoy hanging out at the Civic Center. But again, to what Lauren was saying, perfect place to watch, perfect place to see everyone at the same time.
Yes.
Now, I have to ask the question, and try to do this as delicately as I can. Roller derby is known, I guess, for mature women who've been out there, but your young ladies that have gotten involved, how many members of the team now are we'll say under the age of 30?
Well, I still am currently.
I think the really spectacular thing about roller derby is that we really bring in all types.
Yeah.
And when we do these call outs and when these girls graduate into the programs, it's so fun learning a little more about them. I mean, we have people from all walks of life. They may be the under 30 crowd. They may be mothers. They may be grandmothers. We have engineers, hairdressers, teachers. We have a ton of different people with stories and backgrounds, and we all come together for one single cause, which is so fun. And I think it really builds us not just as a team, but like Lauren talked to earlier, friendships that you like would have never really thought.
It's almost like an extended family, isn't it?
It really is. Yes. Yeah, oh, my
sure is. Sure is.
Absolutely. So. We've been invited to birthday parties, you know, baptisms. I mean, even graduation parties with everyone.
Well, and you mentioned, too, and this was happening with the call-out coming out on July 8th, the fact that it's for skaters and for non-skaters. So, obviously, there's some people that may be a little bit leery of learning how to skate, and certainly to be able to do something like this. But they have something that they can do to help the team along, sounds like.
That's true. And as we're a team that's league-run, so we don't just show up and skate every day. We have different committees that help fuel us forward. So, Lauren's with our PR, marketing, we have events, we have personal training, we have our merchandisers. So we all have our own strengths that we bring to keep the league running. So we're
for the skaters,
by skaters.
Once again, the South Shore Roller Girls Derby call out is going to be on this coming weekend, July 8th, as a matter of fact. It's going to be at the Skate World, which is, again, at 3600 Scottsdale Street in Portage. Begins at 11 o'clock in the morning, and that's where anybody can come out and learn more about the team, about the roller skate derby action. And then the big event is coming up for the fifth birthday bout, we should say, and the doubleheader is going to happen on Saturday, July 14th, and it's going to be at the Hammond Civic Center, which is at 5825 South Soul Avenue in Hammond, just north of 8094. And if you know where the Hammond Civic Center is, if you've been to the Civic Center, you know what the building may be like, but have you ever been there during a roller derby? Mm-hmm. Well, here's your chance to find out by attending and cheering the team along here on Saturday, July 14th. We've had in the studio to talk about the South Shore Roller Girls, Lauren Reducen, and to her teammate and friend, Ellen Capitan. And ladies, thank you for spending time with us to talk about not only the team, about the interest of the Northwest Indiana has historically had, apparently, in roller derby, but what the team is going to be doing here in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad that you came by. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by Ben Sound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.